Hello, in the 20th century, our notions of physical space have been revolutionized. Einstein said that space was not a separate entity. We've probed and explored the outer reaches of our physical space with spaceflight, powerful telescopes, and theoretical physics. But in the last 20 years, with the birth of the Internet, a virtual form of space has been introduced to us, cyberspace, where people can meet and communicate ideas. You sit at home, punch the keys, and you can rove all over the world. The keyboard becomes a magic carpet. But does cyberspace introduce a new concept of space in our world, or does it really have its roots in Einsteinian physics, or even in medieval theology? To discuss this phenomenon of our time, I'm joined by the Reverend Dr. John Polkinghorne, a distinguished scientist as well as being an ordained priest, a fellow of Queen's College, Cambridge, and canon theologian of Liverpool. He spent his scientific career as a theoretical physicist, looking at elementary particles. For him, religion and science are united in their quest for ultimate truth in the universe. And Margaret Wertheim is fascinated alike by religion and science, author of the critically acclaimed Pythagoras' Trousers, which looked at religion's intimate historical connection with physics. Today she publishes her latest book, The Pearly Gates of Cyberspace, A History of Space, From Dante to the Internet. Just for those who are slightly fuzzy and unclear about it, Margaret Wertheim, could you briefly tell them what cyberspace is?
Well, I think that you can see cyberspace basically as being this collective immaterial space that I, in some sense, go into when I'm online on the Internet. Now, the Internet is, if you like, the physical collection of technologies, the computers that make up the servers and the connections in between them, the physical landlines and the optic fibres. And cyberspace is, if you like, the immaterial, non-physical space that is the emergent property that comes out of this physical hardware. I think the best way of looking at it is perhaps to say that when I'm online, I am sitting there, my body is sitting there in the chair in front of the computer, but I, or at least some very important part of me, some powerful part of me, is in a very real sense in another place, another space of being, which I actually think is becoming an increasingly important space of being as another space of being in addition to the physical space of our bodies.
So you're sitting there and you're pumping in these messages and they're being pumped back to you around the world and you're communicating with people by, as it were, electronic letters, and you're raiding libraries and they're raiding your libraries and you're going to websites. And so out there somewhere is your mind and maybe more than your mind. That's what's going on, really, as you're sitting in your study.
Well, I wouldn't say that your mind leaves your body and goes into cyberspace. Obviously, your mind, in some sense, stays with you in the physical body, too. But I think there is a very real sense in which, in some sense, your mind also goes out into this other space. I mean, when one is surfing around, one has a very powerful sense, at least I do and a lot of other people I've talked to who do spend a lot of time online, have this sense that there is a very real landscape and geography there, particularly when you're in these online worlds known as MUDs. They have a very powerful sense of being in another world, which not only enables you to communicate, but it actually has its own architecture, its own geography, if you
Yeah, it's just huge claims. Is it much different from reading a book? I mean, when I read a book, my body's there, and I'm reading, I don't know, Anna Karenina or Salman Rushdie or whoever it is, and off you go, following the characters that plot the situation. Can you explain to people who are not as intrigued by cyberspace as you are why this is fundamentally different?
Well, actually, I don't think it's fundamentally different from that. I totally agree, and this is a point I actually make in my book, that, in fact, all literature is, in fact, a creation of a virtual world. Something like the Divine Comedy or the Iliad is, of course, an expression of a very powerful virtual world that one very much does feel a sense that one is in when one is reading.
We could use fictional for virtual, couldn't we?
Yeah. Well, not in. Well, I think there is a difference in that. When I read Anna Karenina, I feel like I'm in the virtual world of Anna too. The difference with cyberspace.
Why do you have to use virtual instead of fictional? I'm not trying to be clever, but just as a
well,
interest.
Well, it's just that historically that is the word people have. Yeah. People are using. We talk about virtual worlds. That's not a term that I use. In fact, it's not a term I'm entirely happy with, but it is the historical term that people have decided to use. The difference, I think, with cyberspace is simply that it allows these things to happen in real time collectively with all sorts of other people.
Yes.
When I'm reading Anna Karenina, I'm reading it by myself. If I'm in a MUD world, I can be in it with thousands of other people all over the world. But I totally agree with you, and one of the claims of my book is that, in fact, cyberspace is not this totally new thing, that all of these other things like fiction are in fact precursors, and so I believe very much is television.
John Polkinghorne, what's your view of cyberspace before we get on to the ideas inside it?
Well, I think it's not qualitatively different from the world of literature. It differs perhaps in some details. One is that it is, of course, very, very extensive, and it creates these fantasy worlds. Now, literature also deals with fantasy, but great literature deals with real life. It creates a fictional world that reflects back on real life. That's the power of Anna Karenina, that it deals with human relationships. One of the dangers of the cyber world, I think, is that it does prove very addictive in the sense of helping people to live diminished, illusory fantasy worlds in which they are, great heroes or whatever it may be.
Why is it to be diminished? It is illusory, we'd grant you, but why does it have to be diminished?
Well, it's diminishing if the pictures and images that are being presented do not themselves reflect back on human reality. If it is just a constructed world with a great emphasis on fantasy, and of course that's not true of all of the cyber world, there's a great deal of information in it and things like that, but I think the things we're particularly thinking about, these virtual worlds, these mugs and things like that, are very encouraging and obviously very addictive to people who spend, tens of hours a week in an unreal world. I'm just a little bit worried about that.
I think that's very right, that they can be addictive, and certainly I know people who have become addicted to them. In fact, one friend of mine almost lost his relationship because he was spending so much time in a mud world. But then on the other hand, I have other friends who, one woman who said to me that in fact she found the experience of participating in this mud very powerful because she was someone who was very shy and rather overweight. And she felt that in the flesh she was often judged by the fact that she was overweight, and she actually found it a very liberating and for her a very positive experience to be able to be online in this world where people couldn't immediately judge her by the way she looked. So I think it works both ways. There's no question it can be addictive, escapist fantasy. Mm. So can television, so can literature.
Of course.
And cyberspace, in a sense, just has all the dangers that all these other things too.
But it perhaps in a
both positive and negative.
Enhanced form, because it's powerful.
Can I come to somewhere near the centre and the most fascinating thing about Margaret's book and put a quotation of hers to you, John?
Sure.
In the book, you write, "Cyberspace is an attempt," I'm quoting, "is an attempt to realise a technological substitute for the Christian space of heaven, a place where we will be freed from the limitations and embarrassment of physical embodiment." Now, what's your reaction to that?
My reaction to that is a great deal of caution. The cyber world is a human-created world containing a great deal of illusion, and it's a world that comes to an end when you pull out the plug. The Christian heaven is a divinely sustained world of a destiny beyond death that is concerned with reality, and which will be everlasting because God's faithfulness will keep it that way. So I think the two should not be confused in any way, and that's, again, an illustration of the dangers of fantasy if you make any equation between them. Secondly, it is intrinsic to us as human beings that we are embodied. It is dangerous for us to think that we are angels, because that's not what we are. And of course, a Christian hope of a destiny beyond death has always been that of resurrection, of a re-embodied life. We are not floating free in a sort of astral plane, whether it's a spiritual astral plane or a cyber plane. We mustn't replace turn pie in the sky, which is a distortion of the Christian thing, to pie in the computer, which would be even more distorting.
What's your reaction to that, Margaret?
I actually totally agree with everything that John just said, because in effect what I'm trying to say in my book is not that I buy into this notion, but that there are an enormous number of people, particularly in America, who are saying that cyberspace will be a new form of heaven, a place where we can ultimately download ourselves as disembodied spiritual beings and
you
live forever in cyberspace.
You actually talk of the soul.
Space.
I mean, not to get to the heart of the matter, but the soul of the matter. You say that cyberspace is a technological substitute for that ultimate Christian space called the soul.
Yes.
Now, can you develop that?
Yes. What I would just like to make clear, though, is I'm not saying that I believe that. What I'm reporting on is a sociological phenomena that a lot of the gurus and champions of cyberspace in America are making this claim.
Fine, okay.
And so what I'm trying to do is understand why the claim is made and on what basis such a claim could be made.
Let's start with why first and then go into what basis.
Yeah.
Why is the claim made?
Well,
why is it being made now?
Well, I think that what is going on here is that many people in the modern world are not, like John, a formal religious believer, but they are desperately seeking for some sort of spirituality in their lives, and they do have a very real sense that they are not just the matter of their bodies, that they are in some sense a spiritual being, and they want to have, if you like, a home for the soul. And in the age of modern science, we've had a profound problem because we have had a picture of reality that recognizes only physical space, and that in therefore we have had a cosmological picture in which we could recognize only our bodies and we could locate only our bodies. And this immaterial I, this soul, spirit, psyche, whatever word you want to use, has, if you like, kind of been pushed out of the realm of reality because there's no space for it, which the medieval world picture had. And I think that that has caused, if you like, not only a spiritual crisis, but a psychological crisis. And so many people, if you like, are looking for a space for their spirit, their soul. And by being a non-material space, people are saying, because it's a non-material space, cyberspace must be a place where my soul could be.
You are talking very specifically about space, if I can reassure listeners that what we're talking about is exactly that. That at the time of Dante, we'll come to Dante in a moment, there was literally space in the diagram of the world as it was known.
Yes.
And outside the known world, there was this huge space, which was heaven, and that is the space in which to which the soul could go, where angels belonged, where God belonged. That was that space.
Yes.
And you're saying, particularly since Newton, going back to the ideas of Aristotle, there is no nothing, there is no space for anything. And so cyberspace, this interconnection, is a place where there can be a soul. That's what's being picked up by your gurus. Okay, John Polkinghorne, what's your view?
Well, I agree with Margaret that I think there are a lot of wistful non-believers around who would certainly want to believe that there is more than simply matter, simply the bits and pieces, the atoms and molecules that make us up. But I think to look into cyberspace for that is the wrong way to look, because we're not just computers made of meat. We're something much more subtle than that. There are good arguments for saying that the brain is much more than just a very complicated computer. And in fact, interestingly enough, there are just hints and encouraging hints from science itself of how one might think about it. You see, if we're thinking about information, about pattern, as a lowly picture of what the soul might be, then we want it to be embodied in some way. We want it to be connected with the human body, not just floating out there in this electronic, artificially created space. Now, there's something called complexity theory that's coming along. It's just an infant science at the moment. People are just studying computerized models. If they find when they study these very complex systems, that they develop quite astonishing patterns of large-scale order. In other words, if you're going to describe these systems, of course you need to describe the exchange of energy between the bits and pieces, but that's not enough. You need a complementary description in terms of pattern and structure.
But complexity theory is only, it's very tentative at the moment, isn't
it,
John? It's the randomness, the interdependence of states, but it is technical. There's no mathematical equation for it at all. Why do you seek to have, as it were, physical proof and validity for your religious conviction?
Well, I'm not quite seeking that. What I am seeking is to understand what I am as a person. I think I'm a psychosomatic unity, as people say. In other words, I don't think I'm an apprentice angel. I don't think my soul is a detachable spiritual bit of me. I think I'm just an animated body. But I'm more than the material of my body, which is changing all the time through eating and drinking, wear and tear. And what I really think the soul is the almost infinitely complex information-bearing pattern in which the material of my body is organized. That's a very old idea. It goes back to Aristotle, who said that the soul was the form of the body, and Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages took that up. Aquinas didn't believe in the Platonic picture of apprentice angels. He thought we were just exactly that. And I think that if people have this wistful desire to recover the soul, absolutely right. We are certainly more than just bits and pieces. That's the direction in which to look. Of course, it's a very infant, rude, undeveloped subject at the moment.
This, your view, would be very hotly contested by people who are in the driving seat of intellectual science at the moment: Dawkins, Dennett, Pinker, the idea of seeking a soul in this way.
Well, it would be contested by them. Whether they're in the intellectual driving seat of science at the moment is an extremely contestable judgment.
Yes, I agree with John.
It will
that.
Be contested by reductionists who go for a quick fix, an easy answer. Dennett says that essentially that we are just computers, anarchic computers. He's, in his grandiosely entitled book, Consciousness Explained, he never deals with awareness, he never deals with feels, what it is to perceive a patch of pink. Tremendous claims are being made which are just unsubstantiable. I don't think that's the driving seat of intellectual advice.
Well, I think they could be going the wrong way, but there's no doubt they are making the argument, John.
They're making the argument. We're making the argument against.
Yeah,
aren't we?
No,
well, this is opportunity knocked,
yeah,
but never.
Yeah.
Margaret Bertrand.
The interesting thing, I think, is that precisely what you're saying, John, is what is going on with the cyber community. Mm. And what I think is interesting about these cyberspace people is that they do actually represent the opposite trend. Well, many of them do, because their claim is that, in fact, there is this immaterial pattern that is the essence of a human being. And, in fact, I think what they're doing is reinventing in cyber form some sort of version of the soul, which I sort of
refer to. Yeah, but it's a diminished version.
I totally agree.
The software running on the hardware.
No, exactly.
That doesn't work.
But their claim is the very opposite to the people like the Dawkins. They actually want to say that there is this immaterial, essential me that can potentially live forever, that I could potentially download into cyberspace.
Can I bring us to Dante, who plays a big part in your book, and you and John may disagree here. You make the claim that Dante's great poem, The Divine Comedy, was the first virtual world, and we can go from Dante's Divine Comedy to cyberspace and get lessons from it. Can you briefly tell us why this is important to your notion?
Yes, I think the remarkable thing about the Divine Comedy for me is that it's the most beautiful and poetic vision of the medieval world picture, and that what we see there is not only a complete picture of the physical world as described by medieval science, but we also see a complete picture of what medievals really understood in a sense as, if you like, a spiritual cosmology. And
the circles of
heaven and the various cornices of purgatory. And what Dante really shows you is, in a poetic form, how for the medievals, the immaterial reality of the soul, the cosmology of soul, in a sense mirrored and reflected the physical cosmology of which their science described. So the medievals lived in a genuinely dualistic world. They did believe that there was a spiritual space of the soul and a physical space of the body, and these were two parallel realities. For them, however, unlike in the modern world, the primary reality was the underlying reality of the spirit, of which the material world was, if you like, the secondary reflection. And Dante shows us this not only in beautiful theological terms and poetic terms, but I also think, as the point John made before, that it is, in my mind, one of the most remarkable articulations of what it is to be a human being in a psychological sense, and I think it can be seen as the great work of pre-Freudian psychology. So he weaves together theology, science, and poetics in a way that is a truly holistic vision, but he shows us that for medieval people, reality was not just the physical.
What's your reaction to that, John Paul?
Well, my reaction is a little bit cautious. I mean, I'm not at all sure that Dante took his geography seriously. It has a high symbolic element to it. I think the best part of the Divine Comedy actually is Purgatory, which is really hopeful. People work their way up the mountain, and the mountain shakes with hallelujahs when anybody takes the next step upwards. Hell's too sadistic and heaven's too vague, as I think you say in the book.
Yes. I
think these things are symbolic. I don't think that Dante thought he was fusing physical geography with spiritual geography in quite the way I think that you're suggesting.
No, I don't mean to imply that it's a literal thing. I think for the medievals it is symbolic. But the question arises, did Dante and his contemporaries really believe there was a conical mountain of purgatory in the southern hemisphere? And I think that question is really a modern question, because for us it couldn't really exist, because we've circumnavigated the globe and we know there is no physical mountain of purgatory. But for them it wasn't a physical question. They weren't obsessed with the notion that things were only real if they could be located in physical space.
There's one cyber world, if you like, which is not a humanly created world, to which we have access, and most scientists would agree we have access. That's the world of mathematics. Most mathematicians think that they are discovering things. The Mandelbrot set was there before Mandelbrot found it, so to speak. Now, that's the sort of...
things already exist.
They exist, and you find them out. Mm. We have this amazing power to explore that world and make big discoveries. It's not just a game that we're constructing the way we might construct a cyber game. That's a very interesting thing.
You've discussed that, of course,
in your earlier book. And that seems to be a world, which is a world of thought and not a world of physical things, to which we undoubtedly have access. And I think that's where I'd look for a way of anchoring, if you like, a noetic world, a mental world, in modern thought.
What is it, Galileo? I've discovered that the language of the world is written in mathematics.
Absolutely, yes.
And so what does that tell you, John Polkinghorne? If things are there to be discovered, is your conclusion, or do you draw from that they were put there by someone to be discovered?
Well, I think that the world of mathematics seems to be a world of everlasting truth, and you're absolutely right that that world, which is an abstract world in some sense that we can explore with our minds, is also anchored in the physical world in the sense that mathematics is the key to unlock the secrets of the physical universe. The search for beautiful equations is a technique in theoretical physics.
So where does that take you to go
well,
back
Well, what
to...
that takes me is to say that the world that is interpretable mathematics in that way is a world shot through with signs of mind in its beautiful pattern and structure. And that suggests to me that there is indeed a mind, a capital M divine mind, behind it. I see theoretical physics in that sense as witnessing to the mind of the creator.
So, and how do you move from that mind to the soul? And you still feel with Margaret Wertheim, or Margaret Wertheim's gurus, whatever. Let's presume it's your argument, it gets too complicated.
Except that I'd like to make the claim that I don't actually agree with it.
You do come in very emphatically behind it again and again, but I accept the distinction. It's just getting in the way at the moment.
Yeah, okay.
Where is this space for the soul?
Well, I think we're amphibians, that we have a foot in both worlds. We have a foot in the physical world. Just hit me on the head with a hammer makes that pretty clear. We have a foot in a mental world of some sort. And I'm appealing to our mathematical experiences just as an illustration of that. And so I think that we just have this dual character. But the dual character is not that there are two bits of us, a mental bit and a physical bit that are, say, for example, separated at death, and the mental bit's the real bit that really matters. They're somehow integrated in this way. And I'm looking for models, and of course they're kiddies' toys, really, intellectual toys, in the sense that we don't understand what we are ourselves. We flail around a bit, wave our arms. But I think things like the general generation through just a little hint in a hopeful direction. Yeah. A hopeful direction, not for defending religion, but for understanding humanity.
Yes. Well, Margaret Wertheim, we go, in your book, we go through Newton, and we go through the Enlightenment, but I'm belting through that because we're belting through our allotted time. And I'm coming to the 20th century to now, when people like Paul Davies and Stephen Hawking have equated the drive for theories of everything. Theories of everything, unattractive, never mind. Theories of everything, they've equated that with God. Yet you say this is little more than a set of equations.
I think the problem is that if I don't have any problem with the notion that theories of physics can ultimately, in some sense, be a reflection of God, because, of course, in a Christian sense, the whole of nature is, in some sense, a reflection of God. What I have an objection to with some of these people is that they seem to want to reduce God to nothing but a set of equations. And, of course, that cannot be the case. God is not, in any Christian sense, just a bunch of equations who created the God. He must also be the God of salvation if he's to have any real theological meaning. And I do not see the link between the God of Christian salvation and the God who is expressed in the theories of quantum mechanics and relativity.
But I come back to you, John Polkinghorne. I mean, you're a very eminent physicist. You've got these people of great intelligence, with Hawking. I mean, that's not mess about. And they are bringing this to bear. Physicist, the scientific knowledge, on the idea of religion. Now, I come back to a question I asked you earlier. Why is it important to you? Why do you think that it is important that religion, which most people have seen hitherto let's just take Christian religion for the last 2,000 years, as being an act of faith, a leap of belief, why is it important that should have the confirmation, the underlining, the consolation of physics?
Well, it's important because truth is one, and truth is the essential religious question. Faith isn't a question of shutting your eyes, gritting your teeth, and believing impossible things, because the Bible or something tells you that's what you've got to do. It's the search for truth, and ultimately, I believe, the search for truth is the search for God.
I mean, a lot of people thought it was that they received faith, didn't they? They were struck by faith.
Well, faith is a commitment to the truth. Science involves, actually, an act of faith in that sense. It involves a commitment to the intelligibility of the physical world. Now, part of that truth is the truth that physics reveals, and I very much hope my friends and colleagues in my old subject of particle physics will one day discover a grand unifying theory, a GUT, another unattractive acronym.
Yes, you're not very good at these acronyms, are you?
If they do discover a GUT, it won't even be a theory of everything in physics. If I could write the equations of particle physics on my T-shirt, that would be great. But it wouldn't explain to me how bulk matter behaves. It wouldn't explain turbulent fluids and things like that. Even in physics, it wouldn't be a theory of everything. And we're very much more than just being physical things. The real theory of everything, I think, is theology. Because theology is the human attempt, the limitedly successful human attempt to understand God. And if God is the ground of everything, then the more we understand God, the more we will understand everything.
Do you think that cyberspace, given that it is very, very recent and has developed with extraordinary rapidity, and the fact that it's developed with such rapidity and people are so greedy for it, and I mean that, you know, well, if greed can be good. Anyway, they are greedy for it. That it's got power. Where do you think it's going to take us?
Well, I think there's no question that more and more things are being done online. Schools, for instance, are having kids...
Yeah, but intellectually, where will it take us?
Oh, well, I think that it is developing into a very powerful collective alternative space of being, another very powerful place where we will increasingly spend time. And for me, the really positive aspect of this is that I think it is going to force back into our discussion about reality the notion that we must take seriously, that we're not, as John said before, just the matter of our bodies, not that there's necessarily something ontological separate, but that we are beings of spirit and psyche as well, and that this, in fact, I think is going to actually be the thing that will finally kill the materialist reductionist view of life. Not that cyberspace is necessarily the answer, but I think it's going to force us to take seriously the discourse of non-materialism.
So, and you think actually cyberspace is going to bring, is going to deeply challenge Dawkins and
it already is, I think. So I think it already is.
I think it will help challenge the purely reductionist view. The point is it's a good servant but a bad master, and one of the things it can do for us is to enable us, for example, to explore the behavior of complex systems. And we are learning some things from that, and there's much, much more to learn. The beginning of the next millennium will surely see great advances in our understanding of what even just the physical world that science studies in its impersonality, what that world is like. It's richer than the reductionists are prepared to say.
To come back to one of the basic things, finally, in Margaret Wertheim's book, this business of the soul and the body, which Aquinas wanted to bring together. You see, cyberspace is her analogy. Other people are right. Is the analogy of cyberspace being the space for the soul, is it something that you can live with at all?
Well, if it's just a humanly created separate space, I don't find it very helpful. If it's integrated with the physical world, I do find it a helpful image, perhaps, of how we exist as more than our bodies, but in our bodies.
And therefore, how would you take on, what's your take on the soul then, Margaret Wertheim? You've done a lot of work on this, and we know you're quoting other people and so on, but what does this mean to the cyberspace kid?
Well, I think the real question is, many people are looking to cyberspace for spiritual satisfaction. Can it actually provide that? I mean, I think in a sense we have returned to something like the medieval system, in that we now, if you like, we're increasingly living in a dualistic world of two separate spaces, one physical and one non-physical. And people are looking to that non-physical space, cyberspace, and hoping that it might provide spiritual satisfaction. I think it's a very serious question whether it will be able to provide that satisfaction, because it's not ultimately embodied in a real theology and ethics. And so I think it's really highly debatable that it will be able to provide that satisfaction.
Well, there we are. Thank you very much, Margaret Wertheim. Good luck with your book. To Dr. John Polkinghorne, very good to see you again. And thanks very much to you for listening.